So it's my pleasure to introduce the first speaker this morning, David Skinner, who will be teaching us about twister strings and twister strings.
Okay, so let me start again by thanking the organizers for arranging this really wonderful conference. It's had many, many very stimulating and exciting talks. Okay, and I was asked to give a sort of general review of various things going on in twister string theory and related theories. Ambi-twister string theory sometimes goes by the name. So I was asked to give a review, but really just over the past week, I think there's been such amazing, exciting developments that I couldn't resist sort of throwing some of that work in as well. Okay. So a sort of general outline for my talk. I'm going to start by introducing spaces of null rays, talking about ambi-twister strings, as we've called them, and their relation to the amazing new formulae written down by Freddie, Song, and Ellis. I'll talk about various things that you might be able to use these string models for beyond simply reproducing known formulae for tree amplitudes, albeit rather new ones. For example, I'll talk about how you might put these strings on a curved background. I'll talk about how you can use these strings to generate new expressions that look very much nowadays like they're going to provide expressions for loop amplitudes, loop integrands. So then I'll have a little bit of a discussion about what happens in four dimensions, features special to four dimensions, the role of spinor helicity, stuff that you know very well, but to see how it plays out in the context of twister strings, and we'll hear much more about this, I'm sure, from Arthur Lipstein in the next talk as well. I'll also present a new formula for all supersymmetric tree amplitudes in Einstein-Yang-Mills specific to four dimensions. And then perhaps if there's time at the end, I'll talk a little bit about where I think this whole story of twister strings might be going, what at least I would like for it to be going. Okay. Right. So, completely unnecessary for this audience, but as you're well aware, if you want to compute amplitudes using Feynman diagrams, amplitudes in a field theory, normally that's a very complicated problem in combinatorics. You have to sum some fairly simple object, and working out what the object is once you've got a given graph is usually pretty easy, but writing down all the graphs that correspond to a particular process, even at tree level, that can be extremely complicated. Okay? So the recipe is always that there's some object, exactly what it is depends on which theory we're trying to describe, and we sum it over some graph topologies. And again, exactly what type of graphs we allow, how many different types of edges, what the vertices types are, depends on the theory. But the general rule is always something like this. Notice that even with very modern on-shell techniques, again, it reduces to the graphs are different, they're not Feynman graphs, but still there's some graphical techniques that are involved. In string theory, life's very different. There's really no complicated combinatorics at all. One of the first miracles that we learn about string theory is that at every loop order, there's just a single diagram, in some sense, to consider. At tree level, we have a Riemann sphere with lots of mark points on it, and then we just increase the genus to go up. Okay. So while there's no combinatorics, of course there's no free lunch, instead of the combinatorics, you have to do a very, very complicated integral over a moduli space. Typically, we have to integrate some correlation function of some well-shaped fields. At least on a flat background, it's usually not too hard to work out what that correlation function should be. But then to integrate it over the moduli space can be very, very difficult. And we'll hear about various bits of progress from that from Oliver later on this morning. Okay. Of course, if you want to take the string theory, which is a different type of object to a field theory, and reproduce the field theory, then the combinatoric problem in some sense reemerges, because you have to bury deep down into the moduli space, well, deep out to the boundary of the moduli space, where all your world sheets degenerate and become very long and thin and end up looking like Feynman graphs of some type. Now, the formulae that Cacciazzo, Hay, and Yuan have been writing down are, in some sense, a new general approach to how you might compute amplitudes that look totally different. Okay. Again, there's sort of halfway house between string theory and field theory. There's no combinatoric problem involved. We have some object, and again, exactly what this object is will depend on exactly which theory we're trying to describe, but it's now known for a variety of mathless theories. And this object is more or less easy to write down, and it corresponds to some points on a Riemann sphere, just like in string theory. There's no particular combinatorics involved in that. And also, there's no integral involved. You don't have to integrate this over any moduli space. But the price to be paid is that there's an algebraic problem. You have to, this object depends on some external momenta, some external polarization data, but it also depends on the location of these mark points. And instead of integrating over the location of these mark points, they have to solve some algebraic equations known as the scattering equations. These scattering equations here are defined like that, so it's just some Mandelstam invariance divided by the difference zi minus zj of the locations of these points on the world sheet, and you ask that this sum is zero, and you ask that this is true for essentially all of these particles. It's enough to enforce it for n minus 3 of them. It guarantees that it's true for the rest. Okay, so there are these sort of three different ways. One is a combinatoric problem of evaluating amplitudes, graphs. Another is a sort of geometric, doing the moduli space integral, understanding the moduli space of Riemann surfaces with mark points. And finally, an algebraic problem, a way of approaching amplitudes. Okay. I should perhaps mention that these scattering equations, although, they've arisen before in various contexts, as many people are well aware, they were found in some sense, although not published, in the very early days of string theory. They play a prominent role in the high energy limit of string theory of Gross and Mender. They arise as in various guises, as I'll say a little bit more later, in the original work on twister strings in 2003, 2004. Perhaps to point out a connection that people don't normally notice, they also can be viewed as a sort of version of the Godin model, okay, for an abelian group, if you like, for just translations in D dimensions. Okay. And this Godin model, of course, is a type of integral system, and rather like in integral systems, there's been much progress recently in evaluating this sum without knowing exactly what the solutions of these scattering equations are. So this is, whilst it's still a very difficult problem to find the solutions of the scattering equations and a difficult problem to perform this sum, nonetheless, there does seem to be progress going on in that area. But what I want to talk about today, really, is where this object has come from. What is it? What's it telling us about the theory? Okay. And the theme of my talk is going to be that it's really telling us that there exists a new formulation of theories you know and love in some sort of auxiliary space. It may be the space of light rays, it may be some associated twister space. We shall see. Okay. So what is this space? Let's just think a little bit about it. So if I've got a d-dimensional space-time, could be curved, could be flat space. Think about flat space for amplitudes, but it isn't restricted to that case. Then we can define just the space of all null rays. Okay, and for historical reasons, this space is usually called ambitwister space, or projective ambitwister space. So we can easily count the dimension of this space. If I pick a Cauchy surface, a constant time slice, throughout my space-time, that, of course, has got dimension d minus 1, if I've got a space-time of dimension d. And since it's a space-like Cauchy surface, every null ray pierces it at exactly one place. Okay? And through that one place, we've got a whole light cone's worth of light rays, and this light cone is parameterized by a cut of the light cone, which is a d minus 2 sphere. So altogether, we've got d minus 1 plus d minus 2, 2d minus 3 dimensions. The space, and you can think of this space of light rays as being an s d minus 2 bundle over a constant time slice, if you like. And this space has nice properties. For example, as long as the space-time is sufficiently nice, so too will be this space of light rays. Now, it turns out there are many different ways, and they all turn out to be equivalent, that you can think of this space. The one that will be most useful for us, and we'll see that it's connected to some physics that's very familiar, is the following. So if I consider the space of positions and momenta, the cotangent bundle, the phase space of space-time, it's naturally a symplectic manifold with a symplectic form that knows nothing about the space-time metric, just dp dx. Okay. Pick an obvious sort of massless Hamiltonian, half p squared, relativistic massless Hamiltonian, a relativistic Hamiltonian p squared, where this bracket here just means contracting the indices on p with the space-time metric. And associated to this Hamiltonian, on the phase space, we've got a Hamiltonian vector, which generates the flow along geodesics, whose tangent is this vector p. It really lifts to the phase space of those geodesics. Okay. So as often in classical mechanics, we can just restrict to our constant energy surface, H equals zero, and look at the space of flows, so quotient by the flow, so look at a constant time slice, if you like, or some initial conditions on that surface, what you obtain is the space of scaled null geodesics. Okay? Because at h equals 0, p has to be null, and the flow then tells us that I take a point and I flow along a null geodesic with tangent vector p. So if I quotient by the flow, then I just pick a point x in my spacetime and I consider it to be equivalent if I move up and down in the direction of p. Okay. And this procedure of restricting to a constant value of a Hamiltonian and then quotienting by the vector field that generates the Hamiltonian flow again gives you a symplectic manifold. That's nearly the space of light rays, but not quite, because the space of light rays, what we'll get here is I've chosen a p which differs from your p by just an overall scaling factor, a constant scaling factor. So my p might be this purple one, your p might be this red one. They're both null, but this process, as I've described it, will count those two things differently. It will count the overall scaling of p differently. And that's not really the space of light rays. That's the space of light rays together with the parameter along the light ray that tells you the scaling. So if we just want the space of light rays, we should quotient out by this effect, and so we should really quotient by the scale of p. We shouldn't care about the scale of p. If you take a symplectic manifold and quotient by scalings, you get what's known as a contact manifold, and it has its structure, just like the symplectic manifold on the cotangent one had a nice symplectic form dpdx. On the contact manifold, we've got something known as a contact form. It's a one form, but just defined up to scale, because p is only defined up to scale, and to write it this way, I have to remember that p is null. Okay? So this contact form is going to play an important role later. And actually, it was shown by Lebrun back in the early days of twister theory in the 1980s, that conversely, if you know ambi-twister space together with this contact structure, you can reconstruct the light cone structure back in space-time. Actually, in a little bit more, you can reconstruct a connection on space-time as well. Okay, so we want to construct a world sheet theory. We want to construct some sort of string theory whose target space isn't normal space-time, but whose target space is this space of light rays. And that's very easy to do. So just for flat space-time, for simplicity, I'll just use the flat metric in contracting the indices on P. Just write down this action here. So you can immediately see that this is a sort of halfway house between field theory and string theory, perhaps aiming at the CHY formula. Obviously, this is very, very... If I forget the fact that this is a world sheet and just write a normal derivative operator here, it is exactly the world line action for a massless particle. But I haven't forgotten that it's a world sheet here. This really is a d-bar, an anti-holomorphic derivative. And because of that, if x is just a coordinate, p has to have conformal weight 1 for this term to make sense, in which case this term has got conformal weight 2, just like a stress tensor, so e has to be something of conformal weight minus 1, comma 1, like a Beltrami differential. Okay. And the fact that P really has got conformal weight 1 means that under coordinate transformations on the world sheet, P picks up, P is ill-defined up to an overall rescaling, dz prime by dz, if we change coordinates from z to z primed on the world sheet. And so that means that P itself is the sort of component of P in the dz direction on the world sheet is only defined up to a scale, which is the scaling that we want. Now, this Lagrange multiplier, this field E, is obviously the Lagrange multiplier setting P squared to 0, and associated with that Lagrange multiplier, there's a gauge symmetry, and the gauge symmetry for this current P squared, of course, just generates that X and P are canonically conjugate, so X gets translated in the direction of P, and then there's a shift in the gauge field E. And it's straightforward, or at least it appears to be straightforward, to quantize this theory. You can just handle this gauge symmetry using standard BRST procedure. And so long as there are no vertex operators, we can use this symmetry, we can use this gauge transformation of E just to set E to 0. And then we pay a price of having a free ghost action, but in the gauge E equals 0, we've got a completely free action. We've got P d bar x, which is, notice, the same contact form that we had back on ambi-twister space, and together with some ghosts. Now, that looks nice and simple. It looks like a very, very straightforward theory to handle, but let me just emphasize that it's a completely chiral theory on the world sheet here. Okay? My field X is just a scalar on the world sheet. P has got holomorphic conformal weight, no anti-holomorphic conformal weight. Everybody's left moving, if you like. And chiral theories are dangerous. And indeed, this theory has some problems at the moment. So if I do a diffeomorphism of the space-time, a general coordinate transformation on space-time, so x goes to some new function of x, then you'd like to say that p transforms like a one-form on space-time, so it goes like df by dx times p. But the problem is p and x are canonically conjugate, so one has to regularize this operator, and in regularizing it, you break space-time diffeomorphism invariance. It's actually an issue that's very familiar in exactly this subject in the context of beta gamma systems, curved beta gamma systems. Now, another way of seeing the same problem, if we do perturbation theory around some classical solution, so a classical solution would just be that this field X is some constant, so it maps to some constant point in space time, then if little x represents fluctuations around this classical solution, then perturbatively, we'd end up studying this action, and integrating out these fields, we just get 1 over the determinant of this d-bar operator, but the d-bar operator, x now, is a tangent vector to space-time at the point x naught, right, because it's a fluctuation around our classical solution, and so we get a determinant of a d-bar operator with values in some sort of tangent bundle, and this is not diffeomorphism invariant because of the usual phase anomaly of chiral determinants. So there are various ways you can fix that. Of course, one thing to do would be to add back in a right moving sector, and then you get a mod squared of that determinant, which has no ambiguous phase, and that path would essentially take you to string theory. Another way of doing it is to just cancel the anomaly. You can just add in D complex, or as will be convenient, 2D real fermions, who contribute to the same anomaly, but with opposite sign, right? We'll get determinants upstairs instead of determinants downstairs. Okay. Associated with these fermions, there are some new chiral currents, so you can check that the action that we started with once we add this in is also invariant under symmetries generated by p dot either of these fermions, p dot psi 1 or psi 2, and we also gauge that. Okay. So overall, we're left with a BRST operator, which as usual has a world sheet reparametrization invariance, a BC system, so C times the stress tensor, and then ghosts for the Hamiltonian constraint p squared, and some bosonic ghosts for these two constraints. Very much like in the RNS string, but where P is not dx. P is just a new field P. Okay. And you can check that all anomalies vanish, provided you're in dimension 10. Okay. So again, just following our noses and doing what you do in string theory, we can write down some vertex operators for this model. We've got, in the simplest picture, you've got a ghost C, a ghost C tilde, which is very much reminiscent of C bar in the normal RNS string, but remember C tilde, like everything else here, is left moving, not right moving. And then we just build up the rest of the thing looks exactly like it looks in the RNS string, and you can check that this thing is indeed in the BRST cohomology, provided K squared provided we've got the usual sort of on-shell and transversality conditions on K and the polarization. But it's important to note that unlike in the RNS string, unlike in the superstring, where you would again get the same conditions for this vertex operator, in the RNS string, they will come from conformal invariants of this operator. So normally in string theory, with a second order action for x, e to the ik dot x is a delicate operator. It's got some anomalous conformal weight, which depends on k squared. And ensuring that these conditions are true come from checking that this thing really has the proper conformal weight. So it comes from OPE contractions with the stress tensor. Here, that's the contractions with the stress tensor are completely trivial, and these conditions instead come from double contractions with these new fields, H and G, the currents we've got with H and G. That'll be important later. Another feature of the fact that e to the ik dot x never has any... I should say that in this theory, because the kinetic term is just p d bar x, there are no double contractions between... There are no contractions between x and itself. The OPE of x with itself is trivial. Okay, so e to the ik dot x never has any anomalous conformal weight, no matter the value of k. Okay. So in particular, there are no massive states in the spectrum. Now, if I insert n of these vertex operators, so I've got n factors of this, then the equation of motion for x, I get d bar p from the action. I would just get 0 in the absence of vertex operators, but in the presence of vertex operators, I find that p has got some singularities with the location of the vertex operators, and the strength of the pole is ki. So on a Riemann sphere, we can solve this straightforwardly. And so and squaring that, we learn that p squared is this expression. Okay? An expression that's familiar from the starting point for the scattering equations. But that's very dangerous. I've been making this whole spiel about we're going into the space of light rays. P squared is supposed to be zero. Well, P squared isn't zero, it's that. So what's going on? Okay. So at genus zero, so what is this object? It's something of weight two, conformal weight two on the world sheet, like the stress tensor, so it's a quadratic differential, and it's meromorphic. It's got some poles. In fact, you can check it's only got single poles. Any such quadratic differential on a Riemann sphere vanishes if it's got fewer than four poles, just like any one form on a Riemann sphere must have at least two poles, say at the north and south pole. A quadratic differential needs at least four poles. And so, to ensure that p squared is identically zero everywhere on the Riemann sphere, it's enough to say that the residue of p squared should be zero at n minus three places, because it's only got n possible places where it's got poles, and if it's got less than four poles, it's definitely zero, so if all but three of them vanish, then it necessarily vanishes identically. And if you're careful, and we were in the paper, you can go through and check that these conditions on the residues of p squared do indeed arise from carefully fixing the moduli of the gauge field E in the presence of these vertex operators. Okay? So the main message of what I've said so far is that the scattering equations, you can check, well, it's easy to see that the residue of P squared at ZI, it's got a pole there, so we just set Z equals ZI here, and we just get the sum over KI dot KJ, summed over J not equal to I of ZIJ, exactly the equations that we've seen in CHY. The meaning of these scattering equations is simply ensuring that your world sheet does map to the space of light rays. Okay. So, I'll spare you the details, but if you go through and compute the world sheet correlation functions, you get exactly the formula for tree amplitudes in the NS sector of supergravity discovered by CHY. In particular, these two Pfaffians just come from fermion correlators. That's where Pfaffians always come from. You get some sort of Jacobian from solving the scattering equations, and you have to sum it over the solutions to these scattering equations. As we'll hear much more in Freddy's talk, there are now lots and lots of generalizations of this formula to describe a whole variety of other theories. And I said that including these fermions was just the simplest way of cancelling the anomalies that we could do. We could imagine other ways, and indeed some other ways to develop some of the theories that CHY now have from the point of view of a world sheet model are now known, and others are in development. There's various generalizations of these scattering equations that allow the external particles to have mass, given by Nakulich, and it sounds like that's, again, very much out of the category of things I've been talking about, because I've been insisting that everything's massless and goes to the space of light rays. But if you really look at Nakulich's formula, the best way, well, one way to understand it at least, is that it's just a Kluze-Klein reduction of the massless case. The masses just come from Kluze-Klein reduction. Okay. The other thing to notice about this, I won't say too much about this, but one thing to notice about the CHY formula is, if you know nothing about amplitudes but you've seen some quantum field theory, you would say that this is exactly what you'd expect to get as the output of some localization formula. We've got a ratio of determinant-like objects summed over some fixed points of some equations. It's exactly what you get in localization formulae. And indeed, this perspective has been pushed by Omori, and he, So he set up the ambitwister string in exactly the same way as I've told you, but just studied it from a slightly different point of view, integrated things out in a slightly different order, and indeed showed that you could interpret that amplitude formula, the CHY formula, as coming from some form of localization in the ambitwister string. So just to quickly explain this picture. So meromorphic quadratic differentials, just like the stress tensor, it's a cotangent vector to the moduli space of marked curves. Just like the stress tensor on the world sheet and string theory gives you a measure on of the moduli space. Okay. So if I pick, if here's my moduli space of marked curves and I've got my cotangent bundle in these green directions, and I pick a particular section of this cotangent bundle, so for generic choices of the external momenta k, my section p squared will be some generic section. Okay. Then, just a generic, since the rank of this bundle is the same as the dimension of this space, you'd expect for a generic section, that it will intersect this moduli space. In other words, p squared will be identically zero, just in some finite number of points, because the rank of the bundle is the same as the dimension of the space. And indeed, that's what happens, and Omori has shown that you do indeed localize at these points. You localize in the base in these points, and maybe I'll say no more about that. But perhaps just to point out that something that hasn't been done yet, but I think really would be nice, is that the amplitude, this CHY formula, as a ratio determinant summed over some fixed points, it just cries out for the interpretation as some form of index, probably the index of some sort of connection on space-time that's maybe equivariant with respect to translation along null directions, something like this. But it really should be interpreted as an index. Okay, to say some words on curved space, we can easily generalize this model to describe maps into a curved space-time, or the ambitwister space of a curved space-time. Px doesn't get modified, but these fermions psi, I've written them as complex fermions here, these fermions psi are supposed to be valued in the tangent space to space-time, and so they pick up a connection term. But now the nifty trick of this first-order action is I notice that this connection term is just proportional to d bar x, and so I can absorb its coefficient in my definition of p, call the new thing pi. And I've again got a free action. Why should this be possible? Why should this be possible? It again comes down to the fact that what's it come down to the fact? It comes down to the fact that the amplitudes derived from this formula describe just amplitudes in Einstein gravity, okay? Not Einstein gravity plus an infinite series of alpha prime expansions. That should mean that the consistency conditions of this model on a curved background are just the Einstein equations, not the Einstein equations plus terms coming from an infinite series of derivative expansions, higher order curvature corrections. Okay. And if you're going to get a consistency condition that just truncates, it's just the Einstein conditions, not an expansion, then you ought to be able to compute that exactly. So it should be that the model, even on a curved background, is somehow much simpler than you would expect. Okay. Well, we're seeing that. Of course, if you do this shift in pi, then you have to shift the currents, and if you're careful about how you shift the currents and you think about how they generalize to curved space, you find that these two curved currents, g and g bar, just some linear combinations of g1, g2, look like that, and the Hamiltonian constraint, which before in flat space was just p squared, which is now this pi squared term with a metric, looks like a sort of covariant derivative, p squared, so pi here, of course, is again d by dx, this is some sort of covariant derivative and a curvature correction. I should say that if you're really careful about quantum consistency of these currents, there are some derivative corrections to these, which you can find in the paper. Now, if you compute the OPE of these currents now, it's easy to compute the OPE exactly because the action is still free. Okay. If you do that, in flat space, we found that G with G was zero, and here you find that G with G, if I also include a B field and a dilaton, it's just the condition that the three-form, Nebuchadnezzar's three-form H really is D of B, really is the curvature of the B field. Likewise, G bar with G bar was zero in flat space. Here it's just a Bianchi identity. So it tells you that your Riemann curvature tensor really is the Riemann curvature of a Levi-Civita connection. And in G with G bar, which in flat space was just H, just this P square condition, here we get some anomalies. As a simple pole, the sort of classical term, that is still H with the new definition of H, the covariant definition of H. But there are some anomalous terms coming from higher order contractions, and the coefficients of these anomalous terms are exactly the dilaton equation of motion, with no higher order corrections, and then in the symmetric and antisymmetric parts of this, you find the Einstein equation of motion and the B field equation of motion. Okay? So the consistency conditions for this model on a curved background are precisely the, here in the Nebuchadnezzar sector, equations of motion of supergravity. Okay. And again, these things are arising as anomalies in this gauge symmetry, not from the Weyl-Cheek beta function. That's the nonlinear version of the fact that the conditions for massless vertex operators, the conditions for the vertex operators to be on shell, didn't come from any anomalous conformal weight, any anomalous scaling dimensions. It came from whether they were compatible with these gauge currents. It's very striking that even on a curved space you still have a free OP for basic fields. That really suggests that you ought to be able to use these models somehow to compute amplitudes or amplitude-like objects in spacetimes that are not flat. So one possible example perhaps would be to compute some sort of scattering of supergravity amplitudes in anti-de Sitter space, or maybe, as we were hearing yesterday from Donal, in some Kerr-Shield spacetime. Who knows? So it's something we're looking at. Okay. So another thing you might do with this world shape model is generalize it to higher genus. Natural thing to assume, if you want to compute loop amplitudes, is that you should put this model at higher genus. So what happens there? Okay, so the equation of motion from integrating out x, it still says that d bar p will be zero, except you've got these poles where the vertex operators are. But p, remember, has got conformal weight 1. It's a differential on the Riemann, on the Riemann surface, on the world sheet. And now we're at genus 1, or genus g, we can have some purely holomorphic differentials. So at genus 1, we've got dz just on the torus. Okay. So as well as a meromorphic part, which sort of takes into account these poles and the vertex operators, there can also, at higher genus, be a purely holomorphic part using a basis of the holomorphic differentials, of which there are precisely g, on a genus g Riemann surface. And the coefficients of these things are just some zero modes of p, and of course they look exactly like some form of loop momentum. Okay. So again, what happens to the scattering equations? Well, if we're going to live in ambitwister space, if this model really lives in ambitwister space, again we need this constraint that p squared is identically zero. And at genus g, it's not enough to ask that the residues of p squared vanish for all the marked points. Okay, because that killing the residues will kill this part, but it will never kill the purely holomorphic part. So in addition to kill the purely holomorphic part, you have to ask that p squared itself vanishes at some fixed point, some completely arbitrary fixed point. And you need, for generic genus, you need 3g minus 3 of these. At genus 1, it turns out you need just precisely one of these, and you just need to fix the residues at n minus 1 points. At genus 0, you need none of these, and you fix the residue at n minus 3 points. But again, the total number is always n plus 3g minus 3. Okay, these equations do indeed emerge from carefully fixing the moduli associated to these new gauge fields associated with going to ambitwister space on this higher genus curve. And again, you get some fachions built from free fermion correlators at higher genus. You also get various other ingredients, just the partition functions you have to compute these free fermion correlators. But it's all known. They're all expressions that live on higher genus curves, and you know what they are. You can write it down. So this was something I wrote with Eduardo and Tim a little over a year ago now, and we did various checks, and various further checks have been done. It's a proposal for this has to be the one-loop integrand somehow in supergravity, well, or G-loop integrand, we only wrote it down for one loop, where you have left over an integral over the zero modes of P, that is the integral, the loop integral left over to do. It doesn't give you the loop. We checked that indeed, if you factorize it, if you cut the torus, then what you get is some rational expression. We weren't able to see that it was actually the correct tree amplitudes because you should also have fermions running around the loop in a supergravity, and we didn't have expressions, we didn't have CHY expressions for amplitudes with fermions. And at n equals 4, it turns out you can evaluate these Pfaffians quite straightforwardly, just like in string theory actually, and you do indeed get exactly the correct tensor structure. You get exactly the expected t to the 8th, t tilde to the 8th, r to the 4th coming out of the integral, and then you get a loop integral, which is, you can see, is a scalar function left to do, but at the time they couldn't identify it as a box integral. It was just some complicated integral on a torus. But the real problem with this is it felt like you really needed a miracle if it was going to turn out to be just the loop amplitude. The loop amplitude, it's the integral of a rational function. It's come from Feynman diagrams. Where here, because we're at higher genus, everything in the game involves theta functions and elliptic functions and all sorts of complicated stuff. It just really seemed like, there was no way that this was going to work out. Well, if it's a miracle you want, then amplitudes is the place to be. So it's just last week, by Yvonne Geyer, Lionel Mason, Ricardo Montero, and Piotr Torkin, it's been proved that this conjecture is actually true. Okay, so at genus 1, let me just take you through their proof because it's actually extremely interesting. At genus 1, the world sheet path integral gives us this. We've got our scattering equations, condition on p squared at one point, n minus 1 conditions on the residue. We've got some fermion correlators, which are completely known, but I won't trouble you with them. And we've got some moduli space integrals. So we've got the zero modes of have this loop momentum to do, and we've got an integral over the torus. So this is just d tau in another parameterization. So the idea that these guys had, inspired by an earlier idea at tree level by Dole and Goddard, was just to treat this delta function imposing p squared equals zero at some point, treat it as a contour, or integrate by parts if you prefer, and bring it over onto the 1 over q factor. Okay? Very simple idea. If you do that, then you're relaxing one of the scattering equations, but by sitting at q equals zero, that's the limit where this torus degenerates, pinches off, and looks like a Riemann sphere with two points identified. Now, what happens to p squared? What happens to this thing that we've imposed in this limit? Well, it had this loop part from squaring the loop part, and then it'll have some meromorphic part from all the poles from the vertex operators. In the limit that q goes to zero, the remaining scattering equations precisely kill this meromorphic part, so p squared becomes simply, proportional to at least, the loop momentum squared. And so that 1 over p squared factor that we had just becomes 1 over l squared. And the remaining formula, genus 1, now that we've pinched it, it reduces to this. We've got a residue at n minus 1 mark points of this object. We've still got our correlators from the fermions, but because we're basically on a rational curve now, just with genus 0 now, with two points identified, this object is just vastly simpler. It's essentially no more difficult than it was at tree level. You can write down all the ingredients of this, not in terms of theta functions anymore, but just in terms of more or less rational functions, after a little bit of manipulation. They're essentially rational functions, just the same as they were at tree level. And furthermore, the remaining scattering equations, which again at honest torus were full of theta functions, they again become very simple. You've got a piece which looks identical to the scattering equations you would have at tree level with the external momenta, but there's a new contribution coming from this loop momentum, which is off-shell, and it comes with equal and opposite signs, so they cancel out in the sum of momenta and things like this, and this has a pole at z0, a place I'm calling z0, another pole at z infinity. Those are the two points on the Riemann sphere that are getting identified. So, So for n equals 4, again, it was already known that even on a finite non-pinch torus, this factor comes out to the front. But now, GMMT were able to manipulate, to solve the scattering equations. Now they look at tree level, like tree level scattering equations for the rest, and you get this factor. That doesn't look like the box integral. Okay, this is exactly what you'd expect. If this was a box integral, this would be the one loop 4-point gravity amplitude. However, there's an ambiguity in the definition of this zero mode of the field P, L. Because you'd like to say that if I integrate capital P around the cycle of the torus, that's my loop momentum. But you have to choose which cycle of the torus I pick. If I go this blue cycle or this green cycle, then the difference is the residue at this vertex operator P, and the residue of P square, the residue of P at capital P, my field, at any of the vertex operators is just the external momentum. So L is really only defined up to the addition of some loop momentum. Of course, that's right. There is no canonical integrand in supergravity, because you can't tell me which propagator in which Feynman diagram has got L in it. Okay. Unlike in a planar theory where we can order these propagators, in a gravitational theory, there's no preferred ordering, so there is no canonical definition of L. Exploiting this freedom in a smart way, so just using shifts and some partial fraction identities in a clever way, GMMT were able to show that this was indeed exactly the same tensor structure times the sum of boxes. It is the one loop amplitude. They've done many further checks. For example, at n equals 5, they check numerically that it does indeed give the same correct supergravity integrand. Now, what's so striking about their work is that at the end of the day, although they started from the genus 1 formula, at the end of the day, all the action takes place on one of these rational curves with points identified. So none of the ingredients that you actually have to use are any more complicated than they were at tree level. And because of this, you can really short-circuit all the higher genus stuff, and it's natural to think that if you want to go to higher loops, well, you should just identify a few more points on the Riemann sphere. So here I've got a for-loop thing just taken by identifying four pairs of points on the Riemann sphere. All the fermion propagators, everything you might need on that, looks essentially no more complicated than it does at tree level. So they have conjectures. You should talk to them later. There's a poster over in the poster session. They have conjectures for what these things would look like at multi-loops. Except, well, certainly at two loops, but multi-loops, I think. And furthermore, although we only have fully functioning ambitwister string theories for a limited class of the CHY expressions, at tree level, you know the CHY expressions for any sort of theory, and you can use those to just generate conjectures for loop amplitudes in Yang-Mills, again, in the same way, or in any of the CHY theories, and GMMT do, and, you know, we don't yet know whether all of these conjectures are true. You should find, I mean, some of them they do know are true. You should talk to them to find out exactly what. But it's a rich source of new ideas. I really think this is a very, very promising area. Okay. Let me change tack a little bit. So, this stuff is very much based on understanding where the CHY formulae have come from. But there was an earlier incarnation of twister strings, which was using spinellicity. It was where many of the current interest for many of us, well, for me at least, in amplitudes came from. How's that connected? Well, it's really quite simple. In four dimensions, instead of gauging this constraint that P squared should be zero, we just solve it. We all know how to do that. We just say that P in four dimensions is lambda, lambda tilde. Okay, it's a world sheet field, so I split it into a pair of world sheet fields. And if I take my action P d bar x, and I plug in P is lambda, lambda tilde, then I can write it this way, right? I can bring this lambda inside the integral and get a term like that, and pay a price of a compensating thing where just the derivative just hits the lambda piece, that's this guy. I've written covariant derivatives here because, as you all know, splitting P this way is only defined up to an overall scaling of lambda and lambda tilde. So this covariant derivative accounts for that. And then if I call this thing mu, and I call this combination mu tilde, then this action just becomes that, and we can pretty it up by writing it in terms of four-dimensional twisters. Now, what should these fields really be? Remember, P was a one-form on the world sheet. It had holomorphic weight 1. And it had some poles. It had, in the presence of vertex operators, it had poles at all the mark points whose residues were the external momentum. So there's no obvious way of splitting this, there's no preferred way of splitting this holomorphic weight between these two fields or where the poles should be on the right-hand side. And so all you just say is that lambda has got some conformal weight and perhaps some poles. Lambda tilde has got some other conformal weight, some other poles, and such that the product of lambda and lambda tilde lives in the same place that P did. So it's a world sheet one form with poles at these mark points. There are also some fermions whose origin in the four-dimensional picture is, I'll perhaps say a little bit more about later. Okay. The BRST operator looks like this. There's a BRST operator for the scaling. There's various BRST operators associated to currents. Notice that in great contrast to the original twister strings of Witten, this BRST operator, it involves the square brackets and angle brackets, and so it explicitly breaks conformal invariance. There's no chance that this model will be conformal gravity. I mean, we've already seen by writing it in PX space that it's not conformal gravity. But this is why these twister strings don't involve conformal gravity, if you like. They explicitly break conformal invariance on the target space. They don't break Lorentz invariance. These brackets are Lorentz invariant objects, of course, but they're not conformally invariant, not by themselves. And you can check that all anomalies cancel with n equals 8 supersymmetry. We have n equals 8 twister space. No, it isn't put in by hand. It's remarkable that is the choice that kills the anomalies. Now, I've got a world sheet gauge field, which amounts to the scalings of lambda and lambda tilde, and we're supposed to allow that to have world sheet instantons, as in any path integral. We're supposed to sum over all the possible instantons and anti-instantons. That just amounts to summing over the degree of, say, L. Whichever degree, you can find that only one degree ever contributes. Exactly which one is fixed. So only one world sheet instanton sector ever contributes. Which one is fixed by how you choose to represent your external wave functions? If you do it as Witten did in the original twister strings of 2004, and you put all the external wave functions in twister space, then you find that the degree of L, the thing that lambda had to be related to the MHV degree, the external helicities. Of course, you could do exactly the opposite thing and put everybody in the W representation, then it's the other way around. It's L tilde for lambda tildes, and it's just the parity conjugate version. But there's another way, which is also very nice, which is you could choose to represent the ambitwister space, as we've seen all the way through, it's kind of like a phase space. So we could choose to represent some particles in the position representation, or twister representation, some in the momentum representation, the dual twister representation. If you do that in a clever way, assigning these helicities in Z, negative helicities in W, then it sort of treats L and L tilde essentially symmetrically. They both look like world sheet spinners with poles at either the locations of the negative or the positive helicities. Anyway, so I think my main message, although we'll perhaps hear more from Arthur, is that all these models, in some sense, they're the same. Now, one advantage of working four dimensions with these spinner helicity variables is, of course, we've got a manifest on-shell superspace. So you can use that to find expressions that generalize the CHY expressions, which have the advantage of being true in any dimension, to expressions that allow arbitrary states, arbitrary superamplitudes. Okay? So, with Freddy a while ago, I showed that you could write, I presented it in the way shown by these guys. You can write the amplitude for all amplitudes in all tree amplitudes in n equals 8 supergravity in this way. Instead of the CHY Pfaffians, we've got a pair of determinants. They're built out of more or less the same sort of thing. So we've got some ZIJs, and instead of KI dot KJ, we've either got the angle or the square bracket parts. And we've got some things that look essentially like scattering equations. You can prove that indeed they imply the scattering equations, but they've got a little bit more data because they're aware of the helicity content of your theory, right? They split the lambdas and the lambda tildes. These things, it's just a constraint on the lambdas for positive helicity particles. It's a constraint on the lambda tildes for negative helicity particles. And this factor here is just a simple factor. It just allows you to extend this formula to be true for arbitrary particles in the supermultiplier. You just expand this to extract the coefficient of whatever helicity configuration you're interested in. Just this morning, together with Tim Adamo, Eduardo Casali, and Kai Rerig, we've used inspiration from CHY's formula to obtain a version of this formula, which is valid for Einstein supergravity coupled to Super-Yang-Mills in four dimensions. And again, fully supersymmetric. Okay? So what happens is, essentially nothing. You just include some Park-Taylor factors, and there's a slight modification of these determinants, very similar to the way that Cacciazzo-Hay and Yuan modified their Einstein formula to give Einstein-Yang-Mills. You include some new entries that have got something to do with the gluons. Find the details in the paper. But let me emphasize that this is not just some completely naive rewriting of CHY. You don't just take the CHY formula and see everywhere they've got KI dot KJ and replace it by, you know, IJ square bracket IJ, angle bracket IJ square bracket IJ. If you did that, then you get some Pfaffians, every one of whose entries know about both square and angle brackets. And then you could imagine that as some big polynomial, each term of which knows about square and angle brackets, and then you sum up a load of things if you evaluate that Pfaffian. But that's not the structure you see in four dimensions. You see, this determinant here knows only about the angle brackets, and nowhere else in the formula is there angle brackets apart from these sort of scattering equations. This guy here knows only about the square brackets. They completely separate out. That's a very striking property of this feature, and it's special to four dimensions. Okay, not at all obvious from, for example, the CHY formula. It's not at all obvious in the final answer. We still have to integrate this over, again, you can see that these n integrals less 4 of the locations on the Riemann surface are completely fixed by these n delta functions. So there's no integral really to do. It just reduces to solving algebraic equations, as RSV first pointed out in this context. but when you do those integrals, when you solve these scattering equations, then these ZIJs, they all get jumbled up, and the angle brackets and the square brackets all get mixed up, as you know is true for the final answer written in momentum space. But this is sort of very reminiscent of holomorphic factorization in string theory, right? Where at the level of the world sheet correlator, you have a product that only knows about left moving fields, another term, a conformal block that only knows about right moving fields, and then when you do the world sheet integral, the integral over the moduli, the integral over the locations of vertex operators, it all gets jumbled up. But before you do that integral, there's this factorization. Let me quickly say just a few words about what I think that really means. I haven't really explained it, but if I take the vertex operators that correspond to inserting a graviton and I exponentiate them, put them in the action to deform the world sheet action just as you would do in string theory, well, for a graviton of a certain helicity type, it ends up looking like this. The only thing I want you to take away from this is that we've essentially got some sort of covariant d-bar operator here. So instead of just d-bar z, I've got this new sort of covariant D-bar operator built in a certain way out of the, well, this thing amounts to a square bracket, really. We've got a covariant derivative acting on Z in this way. And this is some sort of connection acting on the associated fermions. Now, these types of deformations of the twister space, we're deforming the D-bar operator. So we're deforming what we think of as a complex, as a holomorphic object in the twister space. They've been well studied by Penrose. It was one of the highlights of the sort of classical period of twister theory. And it just deforms the twister space to some new sort of curved twister space, and lines in twister space, which, remember, it's a holomorphic line in twister space which corresponded to a point in space-time, but what you think of as a holomorphic line, since what you think of as being holomorphic has changed, what you think of as being the holomorphic lines have changed, so you get some deformed space-time out of this. Now, if you do it just to the twister space, so that would be just doing the sort of square bracket part, you get just a self-dual space-time from this procedure. If you do it just to the dual twister space, that would be the angle bracket part, you get just an anti-self-dual space-time. Somehow, what this amplitude formula is doing with these two determinants is gluing these two things together in a very interesting way. Non-trivial, and I don't fully understand it. How much time do I have? Okay. So let me finally just say a few things about where I think, or perhaps where I hope, this subject is going. There are perhaps many things I've already suggested that are clear avenues for what to do with this, but perhaps in a broader sense. So I'm standing far enough away from Zvi, I think, to be able to say that all these theories involve gravity, and so they're effective field theories. Certainly the expectation is that they'll be UV divergent at some loop order. Okay. Could there be a way to turn on alpha prime? Okay. Or to say the same thing differently, can you take string theory and take an alpha prime limit in some way and land on the ambitwister string? Of course, we know that if you take the alpha prime goes to zero limit of string theory, you do land on supergravity, and that is what these theories describe. So at some level, the answer is yes, but can you do it in a kind of illuminating way? Can you do it at the level of the world sheet action, perhaps? There are various approaches that you might take to doing this. One approach which has been pursued, well, I might say it slightly differently, but it's been pursued mostly by the group in Copenhagen, it's also related to Omori's ideas, was that to use holomorphic factorization in string theory. So in string theory, in a closed string, we get some world sheet correlation function that separates into a correlator for left movers, a correlator for right movers, and some integral over the locations of the vertex operators. But holomorphic factorization means that these things separate out, and so we can really think of analytically continuing Z bar to be some independent complex coordinate, not Z tilde. Okay. And then you can think of this integral over the moduli space to be a contour integral in two copies of the moduli space, one for the z's, one for the z tildes, where the contour that you want is to say, yeah, z tilde really is just the complex conjugate of z. That is the choice of contour that you want for the physical amplitude. But contours being contours, if I've got any basis of contours, say gamma p, I can expand any contour, at least up to homology, I can expand any contour in that basis of contours. Okay? So in particular, if I've got some interesting basis of contours, gamma p, gamma q, I ought to be able to take the contour I really want, this sort of real slice, and expand it in this basis with some coefficients, whose precise definitions are rather delicate. Well, there is an interesting basis of contours. What you do is you find a critical point of the Kober-Nielsen factors, essentially, in your string vertex operators and your world sheet correlation function. You start at this critical point, and then you use that Kober-Nielsen factor as a Hamiltonian. You just take gradient flow with respect to that Hamiltonian. Okay, and you construct your contour by just looking at where you get to from gradient flow. The point is, gradient flow, of course, preserves the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is preserved along its Hamiltonian flow. And so if the value of the Hamiltonian at one critical point is different from the value of the Hamiltonian at another critical point, you're not ever going to meet that other critical point on these contours. Okay? So every critical point of the Kober-Nielsen factors gives rise to a new contour which just flows away to infinity, meaning the boundary of the moduli space in this case. But the crucial thing is that these critical points, I said they're critical points in string theory of the Kober-Nielsen factors, But that's the Gross-Mendel critical point, right? That's exactly the same critical points as the scattering solutions of the scattering equations. So I can run the same argument again using the scattering equations. I'll have exactly the same, up to homology, I'll have exactly the same contours. So whilst in the ambitwister strings you localize exactly at the critical points, whereas in the real string theory you really have to do this integral over all of these contours. Nonetheless, it suggests that we're in the right sort of ballpark. I should say this is also very closely related to the sort of KLT decomposition of closed strings, of course, because you think of it as two open strings. Okay. Another approach is provided by Nathan Berkowitz's recent work on understanding the origin of the pure spinner string. Okay, so I've said that twisters and ambitwisters are very closely connected to null directions, massless states. Why has that got anything to do with string theory, where there's an infinite tower of massive states? It sounds like it's hopeless. But that's not really true. If you think about where string theory comes from, it all comes from imposing the stress tensor vanishes. So the sort of mixed components vanish automatically by CFT, but then what's new about string theory is you impose that T and T bar, the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic coordinates, vanish themselves, and all that's saying is that this world sheet vector dx is null with respect to the target space metric. Same for d bar x. Of course, you have to be very careful how you quantize that. You have to impose... We all know the delicacies of quantizing this, the Virasoro algebra that follows from that, but essentially they're no more different from the delicacies of quantizing P squared and getting scattering equations. So you might ask, as in four dimensions for P squared, can we solve these constraints rather than engaging them? Okay, can we work in some coordinates that solves them? Well, in four dimensions, another way to think about this is that if you've got R4 and you want to identify it with C2, two copies of the complex plane, then out of your four real coordinates, you need to choose some way of dividing them into pairs. Okay? And you can do that, one way to think about the incidence relation, is to do that by picking a spinner lambda, dotting it into x, and saying that these two coordinates that I've got here, they are the combinations of x, the linear combination of x, that I'm going to treat as my two holomorphic coordinates on z. If I do lambda tilde, I'll get the two anti-holomorphic coordinates. Okay? So here I've got two complex coordinates. That's my identification of R4 with C2. Of course, if I pick a particular fixed spinner, then I've broken Lorentz invariance. It's terrible. But if I average, if I do this for all such spinners lambda, and I allow lambda to be my usual spinner up to a scale on CP2, or another way of saying it is, it's a point in the coset SO4 over U2, sort of Lorentz, well, Euclidean transformations over complex transformations. then it becomes Lorentz invariant again. Of course, the total space of all of this is exactly what's normally twisted space in four dimensions. If we do the same game in 10 dimensions, which is what Nathan Berkowitz has been doing, then lambda instead should parameterize rotations in 10 dimensions over complex rotations in C5. Exactly the same story, and that is what you mean by a pure spinner, again, up to scale. Oops. There we go. So Berkowitz starts from this action. I'll just be very quick. He's got various fields in this. It looks rather complicated. The only thing I want you to note is this little Grange multiplier here imposes the constraint that this combination dotted into our spinner in the same way as in four dimensions is zero, and that's enough to say that P plus dx is null. Together with some other constraints, that implies that the world sheet stress tensor is zero, and so that the world sheet action is diffeomorphism invariant without BC ghosts. He was trying to find the origin, the sort of ungauged fixed origin of the pure spinner string. And what's interesting is that the fermionic directions of space-time emerge as ghosts for this symmetry associated with this Lagrange multiplier. Now, Berkowitz has been able to show that if you gauge fix this in various different ways, in one hand you get back to the pure spinner string, that was his original aim, you choose a different gauge fixing of the gauge symmetries associated with these constraints, you can get to Green-Schwarz string, and it seems to me highly likely, although certainly not, doesn't happen yet, that there may well be some other type of gauge fixing that leads to the twister string in four dimensions. So let me quickly conclude. So a few years ago, a decade ago, the Witten and Berkowitz strings, they were always a very beautiful and intriguing, interesting structure way to think about amplitudes. They inspired much progress, but they came at a very, very high cost. Okay? It was the wrong theory, had conformal gravity. It seemed that there was no hope of, despite many people working very hard, no hope of extending it to loop amplitudes. It seemed to be a theory just in its own corner of the world, not related to anything that any, you know, that we know about from the rest of theory. And worst of all, it was just too damn hard to do anything with it. Right? It wasn't worth the effort of thinking about. I hope that what the message you picked up from this talk is that over the past few years and months and, you know, even last week, these obstacles are really being overcome. Okay? We have the right theory. We have Einstein's supergravity. We have Super-Young-Mills coupled to it in some ways. There's now an excellent way to talk about loop amplitudes, to write conjectures for loop integrands at genus G. And moreover, it's no more complicated than it was at tree level. It shouldn't have been. It's got to be a rational function. It seems like there are lots of ways to think about how this might be related to very standard, very familiar objects, certainly in QFT from worldline formalism and probably string theory as well. So I really think that it's an incredibly exciting time to be working in twisted string theory, and I expect there to be lots of new results to emerge in the coming months. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions for David.
I wonder which Einstein Young-Mills supergravity is it that you obtain?
So the one where I have a completely satisfactory world-shape model that I'm aware of would be type 2 supergravities, or 2A or 2B in 10 dimensions. Okay? There are formulae for amplitudes, supersymmetric amplitudes, in just basic Einstein's supergravity coupled to Einstein's coupled to super young mills with n less than or equal to 4 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. But I would be lying if I said that at the moment I understand exactly how to get those from well-shaped model. I've got a formula for all those amplitudes, but I don't quite understand at the moment where. There are some good ideas, but I don't quite have it yet.
How many gravitinos is there in the 4-dimensional theory?
Well, it depends on how many supersymmetries.
Okay. But you have so you have all of them.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
This one is Jake. So in the other limit, the alpha prime going to infinity, what does ambitwisted string, or can it say anything there? Or?
So as I understand, the question is about the relation to the Gross-Mendel story?
Yeah, you draw the graph. So if there's some relation to having an alpha prime, can you also say something about the Gross-Mendel?
I would love to be able to. That I don't know whether that's the deepest thing about the whole subject. It's incredibly striking that these scattering equations are identically. And here we're seeing that the alpha prime goes to zero, the low energy limit of string theory, right? Whereas in Gross-Mendel, they're kind of the high energy limit fixed angle. It's extremely remarkable that they're the same. If my philosophy is right, that means there might be some sort of effective field theory of the Gross-Mendel limit that lives in the space of light rays. That would be a natural thing to say. What it is, I don't know. Whether this is anything more than a coincidence, I don't know, but there aren't any coincidences in amplitudes. So.
And does this thing should explain in a way the whole thing, or is it just like an effective approximation?
So, I mean, whatever the Gross-Mendel theory is, it isn't. Sorry, there is a difference, okay, which is that in Gross-Mendel, okay, the saddle points are all the same, but only one of them contributes because you've got this essentially exponential factor from the Kober-Nielsen factors. All the rest are exponentially suppressed compared to that. And so if you go marginally away from this ultra-high energy limit, fluctuations around the dominant saddle point will be more important than contributions of subdominant saddle points. That's unlike the situation for tree amplitudes in field theories where you're supposed to sum over all the critical points. So there are some differences, but it is very striking, I certainly agree.
Just a comment related to Emil's question. In fact, there is no need to send alpha prime to any particular value to see scattering equations emerge. For any value of alpha prime, they are just integration by parts identities, just reflecting the vanishing of total derivatives. That even extends to loop order, like the p squared equals zero coming from a total derivative in moduli. And yeah, there's really no need to send alpha prime to any particular corner to see that close correspondence.
Of course I agree, but if alpha prime isn't in some particular limit, then there will be other corrections which are not supported on the scattering at these critical points.
For sure. But yeah, the comment mostly applied to the symmetry pattern or to the emergence of these identities.
I agree.
I think we should. Oh, all right. We have a quick question. Here.
I mean, the formula that you wrote for going from the 3-to-1 loop for P square.
Yes.
It seems that you have also Z0 and Z infinity. So it looks like if
Z0.
You, yeah, that's, you see Z0 and Z infinity. So it's like if you have two more particles. And so have you tried to get the, using the solving procedure?
I think I should refer you to the authors of that paper, GMMT. Well, at least three of them are in the audience. So
I mean, can you write a scattering equation taking off-shell?
These things are scattering equations with off-shell momentum L.
L is off-shell.
L is off-shell. It's the loop momentum, and it's not been cut. Okay. Despite the picture that we pinched the torus, the loop momentum is not cut. We sort of undid the thing that was in danger of cutting L squared so as to end up on this degenerate Riemann sphere, not on degenerate torus rather than on the generic torus. So if there are no further questions, I perhaps have one final slide. Seems to be in the spirit of the conference, which is that there'll be a workshop at Santa Barbara from beginning of April to the end of June 2017, so not next year, but the year after. You'll all be very welcome to attend. I hope you can make it for some part of it. I think it's going to be a very exciting time in Amplitudes, but thank you.
Let's thank David again.